the last minute. Do you know?
I think it's just the majority of who's here.
Any comments on the minutes from, what was that, a year and a quarter ago?
Yep.
Only thing in looking through that, we since had some communication back and forth, there was a discussion about open-ended work releases. And we're not going to discuss it at this meeting, but we're going to get some feedback from MLAC.
Yeah, I'm going to find out.
See what, how they're thinking about it or what specific issues. I think we explored that issue pretty well, and we need some guidance from them what they want us to weigh in on.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone's that treats injured workers is in favor of open-ended work releases that have no end, but there's no, apparently no specifics on it. Anyone move to accept the minutes?
So moved.
All in favor? Aye. Opposed? Great. Okay.
See, now that wasn't hard.
No. Yeah. We're done. Let's go home.
Didn't have done that. Burned a t-shirt.
And I want to welcome Dr. Hubbs, is taking the position for the chiropractic physician. And he submitted a deck on the PRP, which will be platelet-rich plasma treatment, which we'll be discussing later. Welcome.
Thank you.
All right. Staff updates.
That's me. This is my first one. So for those of you that I haven't met yet, my name is Sarah Kessler, and I know we've been in lots of communication via email, so it is nice to meet the few of you here in person. Also wanted to announce that we do have a new deputy administrator. With Jim's retirement, we now have Matt West in.
I'm Matt West. I'm the new deputy administrator here since January. Been with the division for often, this is my second time here, but overall about 16 years. So nice to meet you all, and this is my first MAC meeting, so interested in kind of learning what you guys talk about.
All right.
So, yeah.
Well, welcome.
Yeah.
Maybe for Dr. Hubb's benefit, Yuri, you wanted to talk about what our role is in the system, the medical advisory committee?
It's really providing advice to what the statute calls it, to the director, but basically, you know, to the work comp division regarding medical issues. One thing that the Oregon work comp system differs from many, many other work comp systems is we don't have treatment guidelines. Many work comp systems throughout the country have treatment guidelines. In Oregon, basically, if the insurer wants to basically apply treatment guidelines, basically they enroll the worker in an MCO, and then the MCO, they manage the care, and they have treatment guidelines. Oregon doesn't have that. So, that would be one area where a medical advisory committee really would shine is with developing treatment guidelines, adjusting them, and we don't have that. So that's one subject that this committee really doesn't involved at all. But we do have another quirk in Oregon is that basically all medical treatment is considered compensable as long as it's for the compensable conditions and is appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
Until and unless we specifically exclude it by rule. So if something brand new shows up on the market, most private health is gonna say, well, it's still experimental, we're not gonna pay for that. In Oregon work comp, that doesn't apply. It's compensable, again, unless and until we say it's not.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really one area where the MAC committee really, really helps us, is to basically do the research and form an opinion whether or not a medical treatment should be compensable. Today, we're gonna talk about platelet-rich plasma injections.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, that's not compensable. And so we're gonna talk about whether or not we should look at that again. And then the committee makes a recommendation to the administrator, and then it goes through the rules process. And then once it's in the rule, then it becomes excluded. So the really just exclusion of treatment from compensability, that is the really big area for us.
So essentially, we have the veto power.
Kind of, yeah, exactly.
Understood.
Yeah. And then, you know, there may be other things that come up during the course of business where we want to hear from the MAC committee about something medical or medically related. Sometimes MLEC asks for the opinion of the MAC committee. So that's kind of it. And we meet 4 times a year. If we don't really have anything, we're not gonna meet just for the meeting's sake.
Yes, I experienced that in May.
Yeah, yeah, so.
And MLAC is the Management and Labor Advisory Committee? Yeah,
yeah.
They're really the powerhouse.
Yeah, those
deals
those
with
members
the
are,
legislature.
The governor basically chooses those members.
Then there are, to be compensable when we look at something, there are 4 criteria, right? There's,
yes.
It has to be, I forget them all.
Yeah.
It can't be experimental, it has to be proven statistically and.
Scientific, it's scientific.
Can't be outdated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sarah, did you get the PowerPoint I sent you?
I did.
Good.
Okay. I did, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And I believe that I forwarded it on to you. I didn't make copies, though. We
that's
could
fine.
Make copies if you would like.
Oh, that's
okay.
Fine.
Okay.
I just figured you could forward it to everybody else in the committee and let
yep.
them look at it.
I will at the, I don't think I forwarded
you sent
them
to me, and Dr.
You?
Jean sent, had some also.
Yes, yeah, there were 2 sets. So I'll make sure that everybody has those
okay.
at the.
I have on flash drive.
Okay.
If I can, I'll hand it to you.
Perfect.
Okay.
Okay. Sounds great.
Just to make sure there are no copyright issues with those if we distribute.
If we distribute?
No, well, the PowerPoint in question was given to me freely by the author of said PowerPoint, so it
okay.
shouldn't be a problem.
Okay. So I have a photo of Mount Hood there. I don't know who took that. I wanted to add to what Yuri said is that the Oregon system is a many. I'm sure there's complaints about it, but it's such a different system than California, where the giant device manufacturers have to lobby the legislature directly. And it's created. You know, that's why guidelines became so important, as their it was sort of the Wild West before the guidelines got imposed in California. And utilization review as well. And so I just wanted to compliment Oregon on its system. And it results in very logical assessment of new technologies. So that's my comment.
For example, what was about 10 years ago, we looked when our disc replacement surgery was just coming out.
Coming out, yeah.
We separated them into the different types and looked at the literature and did a pretty exhaustive review. And I think that went pretty well.
Yeah.
Future meetings?
It's my understanding that in the fall, Clackamas will open back up and they'll allow us to go back up there. So once school is back in, of course, we'll confirm again once we get closer, but the last time we asked, that was the direction they were heading. So it sounds like we'll be able to be back up there and in person.
Has that been shut down altogether?
I think they were, for a while they were, and then they got to a point where as students were coming back on campus, they just didn't want to open it up for anybody on the outside.
Oh, I
see. They were just keeping everything internal.
Okay.
And now they're going to open that back up, so.
That's a building, it says, what, the PGE building or something in Wilsonville?
I believe it's on Winter Lane, which I find hilarious.
Because we're on Winter Street, yeah.
Yes.
Interesting.
So the building should be fall because it's between summer and winter.
Right, right. True.
So we'll, our next one's scheduled November, so that might be there, and you'll let us know.
Yes, yeah, yep. Hopefully that'll be better for everybody. I know that's closer, a little bit closer.
Yeah, that's more convenient.
Certainly for me.
Yes.
Right.
And then for next year, again, I think we're planning to have four meetings. We have them now on the third Friday of the month. Is that good for everybody?
Yeah, I think that, and I think November 19th or anyway, there's a November one scheduled already.
Yeah.
And then we'll see. We may cancel it if there's not anything to talk about.
Okay. Yeah, it's around there. 19, 20.
Okay.
Hi, sweetie.
Tentative schedule for next year then?
Yes, I haven't put it together yet, but it'll be the same.
Yeah.
The same
next meeting week.
4 months. Yeah. Yep. Yep. We'll have that. We'll have that out for next meeting. Yes.
All right.
If I may, just quickly about rulemaking. So the next rulemaking advisory committee for the medical rules is going to be this fall. Probably it's going to be before our next MAC meeting. And so far, we really don't have any earth-shattering issues. The one thing I do want to mention is the fee schedule and the level of the fee schedule. So far, we have received one request from chiropractors to raise their fees, but we have not received anything else from anybody else regarding the fee schedule level. I know things have gotten a lot more expensive, and but at this point we don't have any input from any group to raise or lower any fee schedules. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Okay.
If somebody would like for us to specifically talk about the fee schedule levels, it would be ideal if you could submit that to us by August 29th. And that way we can put it on the agenda. If it comes in later, it may not make it on the agenda. We still may be able to talk about it. It just depends on the time we have. But if we get it, you know, by the end of this month, by the 29th, we will put it on the agenda.
All right. And to accompany a request for something like that, is the person puts it out to supposed to submit data for support, or how does that work?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. That helps, you know, if you can make an argument for something, but it's not necessarily,
okay,
you know, a requirement, but it certainly helps.
Okay.
And you can send that to me.
Well, let's go to pharmaceutical.
Okay.
Justification?
I think it was in 2014, we created this, we call it pharmaceutical clinical justification for workers' compensation form, and it's really not, you know, a justification. It's just kind of an FYI, a list of the most expensive drugs overall in the work comp system. And we just wanted to make physicians aware when they prescribe one of these drugs that this is a really expensive drug that really adds cost to the system. And we listed some possible alternatives to these drugs that are a lot less expensive. And, you know, now we're 8 years later, and this list is not really up to date anymore. The prescribing pattern has somewhat changed. And Don, if you want to come up here, he has done some research about the current numbers, and he put together this memo here. And so if you want to go.
Hi, guys. My name's Don Gallobly. I'm a research analyst for the department. As you're probably aware, the department collects substantial data on from insurers, in particular billing data, and we mine that data for information to help policymakers make their decisions. With regards to these drugs, back in the early 2000, early teens, we, as Yuri said, there was an effort to look at these high-cost drugs. We analyzed the data to determine which drugs were at the top of the list, the most expensive drugs, we have reanalyzed, gone back and done another look to see how things changed, what the effects have been over the last few years. And that's what this memo is about. So if you have it in front of you, I can go through and walk you through some of the figures in the memo. If you flip over to page 2, figure 1 shows that the total payments for those 7 drugs that were on the list. These are the, across the bottom are the names of the drugs. OxyContin was the number 1, Lyrica, Lidoderm, Cymbalta, Celebrex, Cadian, and Ventora. Each group of bars that you see there is like a time series. So 2012 is the leftmost bar, and 2021 is the rightmost bar. You can see that in each case, today we are at a lower level for each one of those drugs. I can't say that it was all our memo that brought those down, but they have those drugs have definitely come down in their payment volume. There's less money in the system for those drugs now than there was 10 years ago. Figure 2 shows the number of dispenses, again, for each of the drugs. And we see that in each case, again, those have fallen. So it's not just the price has come down, the number of prescriptions, the number of services, that is, has dropped. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I have a question. Like Celebrex, I'm familiar with that. It's a generic has been out for a while, Celecoxib.
Mm-hmm.
How does the data deal with that? Is the Celecoxib still considered in here, or is that
no,
separate?
No,
these are just a brand name?
These are just brand name drugs.
Okay.
Yes. So where generics have come out, those are not counted, and for good reason. Generally, they're less expensive.
But would it be fair to say that the drop in Celebrex might be due to the fact that a generic came out, so the number of brand names prescribed went down?
Yes, I think that's fair. Sure.
Could be. And then OxyContin was impacted by the opioid crisis.
Indeed.
That was, when was that, about 16 or so?
Yes. I think it's developed over the same period of time.
Yeah.
And it was, I think that it was part of the incentive to help control these drugs was
right.
The rising problem with OxyContin. And, on page 3, there's a table that shows the rank of each of the drugs among brand name drugs. So we took all the brand name drugs, ranked them by total payments, and across the top for payment year 2011, we show where they ranked. OxyContin was the number one drug by payments in workers' comp. Lyrica was 2. Cymbalta was 3, Lidoderm was 4, Celebrex 5, Cadian was number 7, I don't recall what number 6 was, and Fintoro was 12. There's a good chance that those in between were not brand name drugs, and so that's why they're not, they weren't on this list. But as we go through the years up to 2021, you can see that many of these drugs have fallen in their ranking of among the brands. So Cymbalta is now down to 39th, Celebrex is 51st, Cadian is 159th, and Fintoro, we haven't seen a prescription for that since 2012. That's a brand of fentanyl, I believe.
I assumed it was.
Right. And finally, on the last page, table 2 shows the new list. So again, by total payments, this is the rank of brand name drugs in the workers' compensation system. So OxyContin is still number 1. And I'm not a physician. I'm not familiar with a lot of these drugs. I will probably mispronounce things. Revlimid is number 2. Lidoderm and Lyrica are still there at the top. Botox is 5. Xarelto is 6. I won't go through this whole list, but you can see there are some distinctions among them. Some of them. For example, Revlimid is a high-cost drug. There are very few services, but they're very expensive. Whereas some others, Botox is somewhat less expensive, Xarelto, but there are more services that generate, put them at the top of the list for total payments.
I'm surprised there's still so much OxyContin being prescribed. I thought that kind of went away with the opioid crisis issues.
Yeah, and indeed, you can see from figure 1, it's considerably less than it used to be. But I think there's been a drop in general in brand name drugs, and so OxyContin is still manages to rank at the top.
I have some data on that for my presentation, a little comparison between states. So Oregon ranks higher than other states for whatever reason.
Yeah. What's MACI? Anybody know? MACI is $45,000 per
treatment.
Yeah.
I find it interesting that I guess Revlimid, I'm just looking it up here. I don't know what it is either. It's for multiple myeloma, a disease of your blood cells, and so why it would be
yeah,
workers' compensation.
How can that be?
Maybe
radiation compensable.
Exposures or something. It's interesting. It's an unusual drug for workers' comp.
Is MACI perhaps, I mean, there's a procedure I do, it's a cartilage chondrocyte replacement deal, that is that what the MACI is, maybe? Not a drug, but a procedure?
I have no familiarity with that. I don't know.
It
should be a drug, not a procedure, otherwise you hit
these are all...
Yes. It's a prescription drug.
Yeah,
or
it's
wouldn't have made the list.
Huh.
And so I think that what the division would like to do is consider whether these drugs that are on the list now should stay or be replaced by something from this other list.
Is it they want us to weigh in on replacements?
Yeah. You know, one thing we do see is that overall the prices really have gone, or the costs really have gone down substantially compared to 8 years ago when we created that form. You know, one question we have is, do we still need this form? Does it still serve the purpose of raising awareness of expensive drugs amongst physicians, and if so, should we replace some of the drugs that we have on this list with other drugs that are more expensive now? Again, if we look at the first table. It's really mainly OxyContin and Lyrica and maybe Lidoderm that are still, you know, somewhat up there. But the others really are, they're almost irrelevant. And, you know, if we look at at table two on the last page, basically we see the same thing. So that's kind of the question that I have is, does this form create more of a hassle than it's worth for providers? Whenever we have a form, and this is a form that the provider basically has to get and fill out and send in, whenever we make the change to such a form, it's always difficult to reach all the providers and make them aware that, okay, we have a new form now, you need to use this new form. So that always creates a hassle for the providers and the insurer, because then they have to deal with forms that are out of date, and they may have to contact the provider and tell them, hey, you need to fill out this form. So that's one question I have is, you know, is it worthwhile to change these drugs on this form, create a new form, basically? Is it even worthwhile to still have this form? Or, you know, do the numbers indicate that drug costs aren't really that much of a problem anymore? So these are kind of the question I would like to hear from you from the provider point of view.
Yeah, I think my practice is acute pain and perioperative pain, and I don't really deal with a lot of this. Dr. Lorber, unfortunately, couldn't be here today, but that a lot of his practice is pain, and he has a pain clinic, he'd have some good input on the first ones that are up there. I'm not sure about Botox. How is that but for anyone prescribing, a physician prescribing any of these 20 drugs right now, they'd have to fill out a form.
Just the seven, Celebrex, Cymbalta, Fentor, Cadian, Lidoderm, Lyrica, and OxyContin.
Okay.
Those seven.
And then I don't think anyone, I have prescribed Celebrex, but I prescribe Celecoxib because same thing. It's generic, so I don't think, I doubt there'd be much resistance to using generics when they're available.
Yeah, I think
that's what I've seen. I usually request it myself, but that's an encouraging factor. If in looking at this, it's creating work for the provider, right?
Yeah.
No matter how you look at it. If we're in, you know, and I'm hearing also that if we change the form, it creates a hassle. But we have some on here clearly, like Ventura, that fell off the cliff so long ago that it's another box we're checking, but it's in the way, so to speak. Since I don't work in a doctor's office, and I'm all for work, as they say, I should leave it to the gentlemen here that actually have practice and support whatever they say.
That's the only member here who doesn't use drugs in his practice. I'm sort of on the odd man out here.
Well, and as far as, yeah, like OxyContin seems to be a bad boy there. And I think hassles related to that may be a good thing. Because that's how we got into the, I remember early in my practice, they were pushing that medicine and trying to get me to do it for all my perioperative patients. I didn't want to do it, but there's probably still quite a bit of commercial force out there to up the prescription of that, when we should be getting away from it. So, and I don't know about the other ones. I rely on Dr. Lorber's opinion on Lidoderm. That's just transdermal lidocaine, isn't it?
I think so. Probably.
So that's not an addictive issue. That's a good thing if it works.
I believe that part of the point was to create some extra work in order to raise awareness of these things, I think that nowadays it may just be misplaced, as you say. Some of the drugs are not on the radar at all, and so perhaps we can. The point would be to raise awareness for something else.
Are there any besides OxyContin that are opioids?
No.
Not on this list.
Percocet, I think.
Percocet is an NSAID, but I don't believe it's an
antibiotic. Percocet has...
it's oxycodone.
Oh, does it?
I believe, yeah.
Okay.
It's a mix of NSAID and oxycodone.
Okay.
My big fear is if we say... All right, let's throw it out. There's no incentive then to keep an eye on it. I mean, we could very well see this thing get away from us on OxyContin again. Or people aren't, it's not in the forefront. It's not in front of you all the time that says, we need to reduce this, we need to reduce this for the general well-being of my patients, but also the general public out there. So I fear that throwing it out, it's a bigger headache later down the road than without some kind of proven that says the trend is going downhill and it's now to a point it's not going to be any danger. Lyrica is pretty expensive on this list when I'm looking at it and on the number of volumes here. But if you were to keep like the top four, you'd be reducing the amount of work. This Cadian out here looks like it fell off the cliff as well as Ventura. And it's almost redundant to keep them on a list just to check them off. Contrary to what I said before, it, you know, aspirin works great for me, but not for everybody else. So, I just don't want to see it necessarily go away. I mean, if there's a modification to be made, fine. But right now, as Dr. Bowman said, there's still that element out there pushing economically to run OxyContin out there. And we don't necessarily, we have to keep an eye on it, if nothing else. Keep it honest.
Yeah, and for instance, in my practice, I prescribe narcotics every day I'm in clinic for usually postoperative issues. And when the opioid crisis began, there were a lot of hassle factors for prescribing that has been good because I can say that I can only get so much. Mm-hmm. And where before some patients that are likely to get hooked on it will keep pushing for more and more. So I don't see the hassles with OxyContin as a bad thing. I think there should be some kind of speed bumps for using that chronically. But I don't know if we need that on all the expensive medications if they're not addictive. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. I don't know whether what's our timeline for thinking about this, making decisions on it, because this is the first time I've seen it.
So
it's been out there a while, but you know, I came on board in 2011. That's when this started.
Mm-hmm. So this is we actually have a rule about this
coming.
No, it's already in the rule about this form.
Okay.
And so basically we would like to, if we make a change to the form, well, first we have to make a change to the rule, which would basically come in April 1st of next year. That's when the new rules become effective. And so,
okay.
So we would discuss it with the advisory committee meeting this fall. And then, you know, people can provide advice to us. And then we would publish proposed rules, and then people can testify.
Okay.
And then, you know, we take into considering the testimony and then publish permanent rules.
Okay.
But so it's basically, for this coming rulemaking.
Okay. So we've got a little bit of time to think about this and do a little research then.
Yeah. I think, like you said, it would be great to have Dr. Lorber here.
Yeah.
Because he certainly could provide, you know, his unique perspective.
Yeah, I know, because he prescribes chronic pain medication through his clinic, but he's very stingy about narcotics for good reason, and he'd have a good perspective on how that should be done, because he gets patients that other physicians have made addicts out of through prescribing too much. And, so he'd be good. And if we have another, so in the November meeting, maybe we can go over that again.
Let's do that and talk about that again.
Yeah.
In addition, I think to identifying drugs to be removed from the list, new drugs to go on, we need to look at what alternatives to point to.
Exactly.
It's possible that we could pick a drug for which there is no good alternative, in which case that's kind of pointless. We don't want to say just create work. Yeah, you have to fill out this form, but there's nothing you can do to get around that.
Right.
We would want to choose drugs from the list for which there is a suitable alternative that we can point them to on the form.
Yeah. I mean, one option too would be that, you know, so we have OxyContin, Lidoderm, and Lyrica besides the Revlimid. Those are the top three still.
Mm-hmm.
And these three are on the form currently. And so one possibility would be to revise the form where we just leave those three on there and remove the others that are on there without replacing them with any other drugs. That still would address the three most expensive drugs, but it wouldn't really create additional hassle for the providers. If they are not aware that we have a new form, they still would use this form. The insurer still would get the information that they're entitled to, meaning the provider check that we filed. So that would be another possibility, to just reduce the number of drugs that require filling out that form.
I have a thought on that. This list is fascinating to me because it basically shows, if you look at the payment per service cost, the huge ones represent what amounts to the new dimension in medicine. For example, Revlimid is for multiple myeloma, is a biologic. Simponi, also Cosentyx. And then other ones are the Centrest is an antiviral, as is Somatuline. And these are all incredibly expensive per unit. And so to the degree this list in its broader extent gives you sort of a early warning system about the potential creeping into the workers' compensation budget of these more expensive drugs, you know, you may want to think of this sort of differently than just, you know, the hassle to the doctors. It's more like what's going on in our system. So I just bring that up as a thought point, not to make any recommendation, but I was unaware that these drugs were sort of creeping into the workers' compensation milieu.
Yeah.
You normally think of them in terms of, you know, rheumatoid arthritis or something, but this is like a whole different, very interesting.
What are the mechanics of this form now? So a doctor wants to have a new prescription of the seven that are on that form, then he has to fill that out, and it goes to the pharmacy or to the insurer?
To the insurer.
Insurer.
Yeah.
And then they have to approve it?
No. It's the insurer, they don't have to approve or disapprove anything. It started out as a clinical justification form, where the doctor actually has to justify why they prescribe this or that medication. And that really caused an uproar amongst the providers. It's just another hassle, and, you know, and so we really toned the whole thing down to where it's really more just for the provider to be aware and to just basically, when they send it to the insurer, they basically let the insurer know, okay, yes, I know this is an expensive drug, but I'm still going to prescribe it. So it's really not a justification. It's really
just awareness.
To really raise awareness amongst the doctors that they're really prescribing an expensive drug and that there are other drugs out there that they may want to consider instead. So, it's really simple to fill out.
Another question, would there be any advantage to listing alternatives next to that on the form, so they could pick a different one? If
that's
stuck
what we
for the case.
That's what we currently have.
Yeah, I see. Thank you.
Like Celebrex, that have the generic on there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Does the Oregon OrCOMP system have any oversight with narcotics now? If there are inappropriate prescribing other than MCOs, they do.
Well, the insurer can request you know, a dispute, or can bring it to us as a dispute.
Right.
And question the appropriateness or excessiveness.
Oh, I see, yeah.
And then we would make a decision.
So theoretically, if a provider is overprescribing a narcotic, the insurer can take that to the dispute resolution.
There is an avenue for the insurer to bring it to us, yeah.
Do we have any members on the phone? Thought we had one, at least one. Okay. Wanted to make sure that we get them chatting if they're there.
Well, shall we bring this back?
This is Elaine Schuler, sorry, with Safe Corporation. I'm on the phone.
This is Jenny Walsh from Providence, MCO. Do you have a link to the slides you're showing? I can't find that, so I'm just calling in only.
We don't have a slide, but if you go to our website, it's the form is number 4909.
Okay. All right, I'll pull that up. Thank you.
Yep.
Hi, this is Isabel Hernandez with Healthy Systems. Sorry. I do know that form 4909 is on the workers' comp website, but
okay. Thank you.
Are these videos that are around the room and the ceiling? We don't have a video conference, do we?
No.
Okay.
No. Yeah, why don't we bring that back next time?
Yeah, and I'll talk to Dr. Warber. I see him frequently, and we'll about some of these medications. I'm sure he'll have some perspective that will be valuable.
Yeah.
Because he deals with chronic pain and deals with getting people away from addictive medication.
Yeah. Okay, great.
All right, so we'll deal with that more. And this form is more about the cost issue, not addiction issue. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Should we move on to PRP?
Yeah.
Platelet-rich plasma. I was on, there was a committee of three of us, Dr. Warber, myself, and the other chiropractor was here before. And we looked, and Yuri did an exhaustive literature search. Was that about 5 years ago, I think?
Yeah.
Give or take. What we came up with was there's, like in the deck you submitted, there are anecdotal things that show improvement for some applications, but it's apples and oranges when you look at what's actually being injected. Each company that has a PRP machine has a secret recipe that they're not going to share their industrial secrets. So it's really hard, and some are leukocyte high, leukocyte low, at least at the time we did that. I talked to Dr. Lorber because we knew that was coming up and thought it probably would be good to revisit what's been submitted since we last did the review, but include only blinded randomized trials. So we get a good data and maybe a meta-analysis. That probably
meta-analyses, I think, would give you way better.
Yeah.
Because really what we're looking for is best bang for the buck and long-term effectiveness.
Yes.
And I would say that would be where we would look.
And for instance, it's been shown, I think, fairly good to help with some forms of arthritis, but arthritis isn't compensable
No.
in work comp. However, I don't know how many
effective.
meniscectomies I do where they've got grade 3 condromalacia in there, and that's what's kind of that it's not compensable, but it's also keeping them from going back to full duty and extending the recovery, where a PRP might be a good treatment, better than cortisone or hyaluronic acid.
There's in the data I submitted to you, there was one analysis that showed long-term effectiveness over time of the various things.
Yes.
And hyaluronic acid, cortisone was mentioned, platelet-rich, leukocyte-rich and leukocyte-poor injections. And depending upon the issue, and I think they were looking at ligament tears, the PRP had the best outcome.
Yes, like a hamstring tear or something. It's used quite a bit in sports medicine.
Yeah. In fact, I refer out to Dr. Paul Johnson, who is a DO over at, he's in Portland, who does this. And I also have some personal experience with this. My wife had a knee injury that he fixed. And so I got a chance to watch how this process works. And it's the closest thing I could come to that a layman would get would be, at least it's like he's spot welding with platelets.
Yeah.
And it's phenomenal. He goes in there and she had a meniscus tear, done.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to be said for this, and I think it really needs to be looked at because it could save a lot of money, especially when you look at the statistics that I was reading about comparing PRP to surgeries. And the PRP was at least equivalent in terms of outcome. Consequently, if it's cheaper, that should be a workers' comp axiom, in my opinion. So that's my two cents.
And for instance, like I don't know the literature specifically on PRP with meniscus tears, but there are some that have the potential to heal that we can't use it right now. It's not good.
My wife is a competitive show jumper, and her knees are very important to her.
Yeah. So should we? We probably should make a subcommittee again, or a committee, whatever.
We don't have to form the subcommittee right now.
Okay.
You know, I can start collecting literature, and then, you know, hopefully I'll have that by the next meeting. And then at the next meeting, we'll just bring three copies, hard copies of the literature, and then form the subcommittee.
Okay. That sounds good.
Okay, so I'll start looking for the literature, and then hopefully find.
Then can we vote to pay the people hourly wage that are doing this like they do in Washington? I'm kidding. I know we can't, but Dr. Lorber and I spent, I don't know how many hours going through all this literature, which we did. It's all right. And then we find out the Washington system, the physicians that are reviewing their data, they're all paid hourly for that.
Yeah.
But I don't think there'll be a huge volume of literature like there was last time, because if we limit it to
I'm just going to look for articles after the last one from last year, or last time we looked at it.
Okay. So let's move on, Dr. Jean. You got a show and tell?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
It's still too early. It takes like 2 months. make sure you pull your own charts for them.
Swiss people don't react the same way to American medicine.
Oh, did you get it up?
Yeah.
Okay, great. All right.
I have some data that we were looking at claims data, kind of looking at Oregon versus other states, and you know we noticed. Oregon was the same as some other states in certain things and different than other things. And so I thought, and it revolved around COVID and opioid. Is there a slide?
Thank you. Okay.
All right. So, push the button. And this is a disclaimer. These are my opinions, not Liberty Mutual, not to be taken as a representation of Liberty Mutual. there we have it. Next slide.
So we'll make sure the mic's on, then it'll be picked up, I think, a little bit easier for the people on the phone.
There we go. Okay, great. Next slide. Thank you, Sarah. Appreciate that. So on COVID, just some general information. Go ahead. Next slide, please. This is the USA COVID stats. The main point of this is from the New York Times. The main point of this is the huge spike that occurred around the holidays, and it's come back down for the USA. But it's beginning to creep up again, if you notice, with respect to test positivity rate, hospitalized, and deaths. Next slide, please. Please.
How are the deaths? Are they purely from the virus, or they have comorbidities, you know?
It's
determined?
The answer is, it's vague. My understanding of how they assess the deaths is they look at somebody who comes in with a viral illness, acute viral illness with COVID. But as we all know, people with diabetes, with obesity, et cetera, are much more impacted by the virus than people without comorbids. So comorbids play a part. With somebody with diabetes going into hyperosmolar coma, die anyway. You know, let's just say these are generalities, maybe is the best way to look at it. This is the Oregon data that basically shows the same pattern as the U.S. With the seven-day average on each of these kind of paralleling. Notice that the prior one was up in the tens of thousands. This is, 2,000 is, so Oregon's numbers are better. Next slide, please. And in fact, this is Oregon numbers as of August 16th. The test positivity rate is 10%, noted by the CDC to be way below
because people are doing at-home testing, they don't always report it, et cetera. So the number, that number is thought to be at least 4 or 5 times bigger than they're getting. Not the percentage, but the total number. The hospitalization rate is down 14% in the past 2 weeks prior to August 16th, so that's great. ICU is down too, and the number of deaths is down about 40%, with the total number reported since April of 2020 being 8,310. It's still, if you multiply 10 deaths per day times 365 days, that's a lot of people dying. So it's not like it's going away. Next slide, please. This is, you know, the current deaths are like 19% of what the peak was back in January of 21. So that's good news, but it's still high. Next thing. These are sort of claims rates we're getting for the COVID claims. Now, I must tell you all, and particularly you, that this data is not representative. This is strictly based on book of business, many large customers, and each state has different insured. So this isn't like a direct comparison. But I thought it was interesting that Oregon and Washington were lower, more than half, less than half of what California is. So I found that to be really interesting, and just in terms of raw case rates. And this is per capita. I took the population of each state and divided it by the claims, and then it's a minuscule percentage. And so I normalize it by saying this is all times 10 to the minus 6. But basically, it was kind of interesting. Next slide. And kind of looking at the issue, California has is this an explanation? I don't know, but this would be one potential explanation. California has a presumption of work-relatedness that has been extended. Washington State has it seems to be a less applied presumption of infectious disease, but this may not be the only explanation. Book of business, again, I mentioned it wasn't statistically representative, but I thought that was interesting that you know, to some degree, Oregon's doing better with respect to workers' comp claims on COVID. Finally, we mentioned the death rates. Whatever your beliefs or concerns about vaccinations versus non-vaccinated, the death rates in the unvaccinated are significantly higher, about 6 times as high as the in the unvaccinated as the vaccinated. Many issues relate to this. There's a lot of, as they look at this data, a lot of multicollinearity. That means, it's a fancy word for epidemiology, meaning many similar factors track with whether you're going to get vaccinated or not, socioeconomic, many other different things. But this is just, I thought, very interesting. And next slide, please. The other really interesting thing I found was that when you look at cases per day, the issue of the vaccinations often get panned because they say there is, it doesn't keep you from getting COVID. And that's true, but vaccines have never prevented people from getting COVID, with rare exceptions like some of the polio vaccines have what's called sterilizing immunity. They just prevent you from getting really sick. So the virus attack, you've been vaccinated, the virus attacks your body, you develop antibodies, which is what our PCR tests show. And the PCR test shows the viral proteins. And you've gotten infected, but you've not gotten sick. And so to some degree, keeping you from getting infected is like a vaccine superpower. And to some degree, this difference between the peak here before February 2022, to some degree, the vaccines actually prevent people from getting infected in large numbers. Doesn't prevent everybody from getting infected, but I just kind of wanted to point that out. And the case rates in the unvaccinated are 3 times as high. So anyway, that's the COVID. Any questions on the COVID stuff? The data are a mixed bag, as was pointed out, but I thought these were some interesting things. Yes.
I'm just curious on the work relatedness. I don't know how many depositions I get in about whether rotator cuff tear is degenerative or from the injury or from the industrial disease.
Mm-hmm.
How has Oregon done with that? A number of cases that have been determined to be work related versus.
I don't have the statistics on that, but the back when the virus was not out in the community, claims of work relatedness were much more likely to prevail because there was there's a much reduced community exposure.
Right.
As the virus became generally spread, my guess, I don't have the data, is that the acceptance rate for what was work-related versus not work-related changed and went down. But I don't have an answer to your question, I guess.
Yuri, do we have like codes where that's an accepted condition? We don't need it now, but that just would be interesting.
Yeah, we have some information we can send. We've been tracking on our website. There's some links to the raw numbers. We have a spreadsheet on the website. We'll send that out, and then also broken down by industry. So there's some data on that. I haven't looked at it recently, but gave a presentation to MLAC 2 months ago or so, and I think the acceptance rate for COVID claims is, I think, high 70s, low 80s acceptance rate. So,
okay.
Yeah.
So for other states, the presumption plays into it, but Oregon does not have a presumption as far as I know, right?
Correct.
Yeah, okay. Next slide, please. So we have some really interesting opioid claims data that I was advised that, look, get something more representative than just a single book of business or whatever. And so next slide, please. So this comes from the NCCI, the National Council on Compensation Insurance, of which Oregon is a member and contributes data. And this is interesting. It kind of relates to our earlier discussion. According to NCCI, for 2021, Oregon, this is all the dark bar here is all the other medical payments, and this is the amount of official drugs, and this is the amount of non-NDC drugs that are part of Oregon, which is 5% of all medical payments go to drugs versus 8% for other states when you look at the USA as a whole. So I thought that was interesting that, you're doing pretty good in terms of, that list we saw, look, if you look at the overall expenses for workers' comp. Next slide, please. But one area where, and this came out of some of the data I was looking at from claims data, is that Oregon, both in terms of percentage of payments compared with U.S. U.S. averages, in terms of percent of payments and in terms of RXs written for opioids is significantly higher. In this case, 7% higher for a number of RXs written, and 7% higher, 8% higher for the number of for the amount of payments for opioids. So, we started looking at this because our data showed a significant percentage of Oregon versus other states, and we weren't sure what that was. And this is pooled data from many insurance companies, so. It doesn't have the problems of a single insurance company's data and book of business and all that stuff. So I thought that was interesting. Next slide. This was really interesting. By claim year, they look at the number of cases over time, and as was mentioned earlier, the opioid crisis and all the things that all the restrictions and prohibitions put in by regulatory agencies and the federal government and others definitely dropped the number of cases that have one or more opioid scripts. And this Oregon is still, if you notice, higher than the USA. If you look at the far right column, 35% versus 29%. So there's still more prescribing in Oregon, based on this data, of opioids than in other states. Is that good? Is that bad? You know, that's where somebody like Dr. Lorber would be very, you know, good to talk to in terms of what's really happening. Next slide, please. The other really interesting thing is the fact that MME, morphine milligram equivalents, you know, remember, certain drugs like Dilaudid are much more powerful and like codeine are much less powerful. To make these all equivalent, you use the morphine equivalent dose or MME, morphine milligram equivalent, to sort of make them all even. And so even though the number of prescriptions has gone down, well, of opioid prescriptions, you'll notice the intensity has gone up. Now, this is for Oregon and the U.S. Again, the U.S. is slightly lower than Oregon. This is to some degree the fact that with all the decrease in number of opioid prescriptions, you're basically you're now looking at a smaller number of people. And you're keeping the worst cases, sort of the equivalent of adverse selection, in the sense that the people now that you're looking at with your data are the worst cases that really need opioids. You can't really get them off or have very severe chronic pain, et cetera. But the fact that it's gone down, it hasn't gotten down in terms of intensity, I found to be really interesting and just something to sort of be aware of as you look at all the data. Next slide, please. This is something that's paralleled in the material we were looking at earlier. And this is Oregon prescription by popularity of drug, OxyContin, number one, Norco, hydrocodone with acetaminophen, oxycodone, et cetera, as you can see here. So this is also very interesting. The fact that, you know, each one of these drugs has their own kind of popularity, the drug reps go out and kind of, you know, try and promote various different drugs, I find to be really an interesting thing. It's remember, you know, this is sort of overall drug expenses for Oregon versus other states is smaller, but certain classes of drugs, such as opioids, are higher. Next slide, please. And this is us staring in wonder at the workers' compensation system. any questions on the opioid?
On that last slide, isn't Percocet the drug name for the oxycodone acetaminophen?
I thought Percocet was oxycodone and a non-steroidal, but I can't. But you're right. I think this
I
is
thought it was acetaminophen,
right?
Yeah.
So this would be brand, and this would be
that'd be generic.
Generic and
oxycodone and acetaminophen.
And so that's it. Right. That is one. There is a version, I thought, of hydrocodone or oxycodone with a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, not acetaminophen, but I can't remember what that is now. But okay. Any other questions? And Dr. Hubbs, my apologies. You were right. This did not have. I said it had a non-steroidal. You were correct. My apologies. That's it.
I have a general question on COVID stuff.
Yeah.
What we went through could be a lot worse if we get a virulent thing like Ebola transmitted out there. So I'm just wondering if in the workplace, are there any scenarios, or is there a government agency that's looking at what do we do if something really bad comes up, to react, be proactive? Or are we just going to see who's elected at that time and have hopefully know what they're doing?
Bill Gates gave an incredible TED talk on this. I'm sorry, Governor.
I know Oregon has like an emergency response office that you know, plays out all kinds of scenarios. They've talked about Cascadia, and I can't say with certainty that they've. I would imagine the pandemic kind of would have them considering plans and things, but I can't say what that is. I'm not aware.
But yeah,
of emergency management, I think, is what it is.
Well, on a federal level, I guess Obama started a pandemic response at a federal level, and then Trump ended it because it hadn't been used for however long. But you know, in retrospect, it would be good to have that probably.
It looks like the CDC is going to do some rejiggering of their operations as well, they've announced. So.
Yeah.
The TED Talk given by Bill Gates referenced the movie, I think Contagion, whatever, where, you know, they had some, it really was very prescient. It came out about 4 or 5 years before COVID hit, and in essence described exactly, you know, the COVID scene. And he said the team that you know, jumped into action doesn't exist, you know, basically it was Bill Gates at the federal level,
right? Right.
That they have some people, but they're poorly funded, they are not well staffed. It's incredibly unpopular to try and fund ongoing preventive measures when nothing's happening, you know, when nothing's happened in recent memory. Now we won't have that problem for a few years, but you know, it's sort of a perennial issue. And he had recommended, you know, legislation to sort of enshrined it in. Anyway, I commend the TED Talk to you all.
Yeah, I should listen to that. There was a movie, too, Contagion, that was almost exactly what happened with it's going from, I think in the movie it was bats to humans.
It was sort of one of those open markets with all the different kind of animals in China, and it was very scary. It was so predictive, you know.
All right, do we have anything else? Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for giving that talk.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
I thought the issue of Oregon's prescription of opioids being higher than other states is just something you'd want to reflect on. Why that is.
Yeah, and the next time we meet, hopefully Dr. Lorber can be there because he deals with that a lot, and I'm surprised OxyContin is still being prescribed that heavily. I don't prescribe it at all, but I don't deal with chronic pain either.
Somebody's prescribing.
No, there's a lot.
A lot of them.
Yeah. Okay, we're adjourned.
Think so.
All right.
Good. Thank you.
All right.
By the next meeting, we probably.
Has anybody actually looked at unvaccinated survivors of COVID having more or less protection as a result of having been infected? Has anybody looked at that?
They've looked at antibody levels, but you know, there's different.